Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Good morning to you, 908 on KDXU. I'm Andy Griffin. Thanks for tuning in today and every day. If you're here, hopefully every day. And in the 9 o'clock hour, I have an old friend on the phone line with me today, Chris Stewart, former Congressman Chris Stewart, who is not a congressman anymore. And we were just talking. He's actually happy that he's not a congressman. You don't miss it too much, huh?
Yeah, I don't. I miss you. I mean, I miss people.
Yeah.
I miss your theme music. You know, I'll have that stuck in my head the rest of the day now. Right.
You want me to play it a little? There we go. A little more for you.
There you go. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I miss the people. But people ask me all the time, you know, do you miss it? How do you feel? And I just tell them I really don't. I've never woke up. I've never wished I was back in Congress. I loved serving. It was such an honor. But you know, it's a new phase of life and we're just happy. And the biggest thing for me, Andy, is, as I know you know, and maybe some of your listeners do, but the reason I left Congress is because my wife had a stroke and I needed to be home more than I could be. And, you know, that's a reason you don't second guess. You just know that that's the right thing to do. And so, she's doing well, and I'm happy, and I wish Congress was not the mess that it is right now, but it is.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons. I mean, you watch what's happened since I left. I didn't know, for heaven's sakes, I was apparently the only thing holding Congress together because it just kind of blew up.
You were the glue, man. You were the glue.
you know, I go back, I talked with my friends there, and, you know, they've been a little bit discouraged. But, you know, everyone now is looking at the election and going, okay, things are going to change. You know, in November, things are going to change. And I think that's true. I certainly hope that's true.
Yeah, fingers crossed on that one. You strike me, Chris, and, you know, I don't know you as well as I'd like to, but I know you fairly well. You strike me as a guy that's got to be doing stuff, though. And so when I think a lot of people were like, well, he's going to quote unquote retire and, you know, then be home with his wife and they're going to sit around and, you know, and pick flowers and read books and watch HBO or whatever. But that's not Chris Stewart. I imagine you keep yourself very, very busy.
No, I don't watch HBO. I'm an Oprah Winfrey guy. I just sit around and watch Oprah. So.
I don't believe that either.
No, I mean, my gosh, someone's got to make a living, right? Got to pay the bills. So, and you know, Andy, I've spent, I spent most of my life in the military and then, you know, in Congress. And so we're not a family of great wealth. And, you know, I need to work, but more than that, I want to work. I mean, I think I'll be working, you know, probably up till the day I die. I mean, I'm happier when I'm working. I'm happier when I engage. I think God made us that way, that we're just happier when we're doing things. And so, you know, and when I left Congress, because I left under the circumstances that I did, I didn't have a chance where, you know, a lot of people will announce in November or, you know, maybe January, February, hey, I'm not going to run for re-election. And they have a year to kind of prepare what they're going to do. We didn't. And I honestly had no idea what I was going to do. But some people reached out and were working on some things. A lot of it is very similar to what I was doing before. You know, we're working with some foreign partners. I work with some tech and defense industry companies, a lot of them here in Utah, a lot of them startups. And, you know, they can bring a lot of innovation to our warfighters. So it's some things I was doing before. And I'd say it's been fun, but we're busy.
Do you still fly airplanes or is that part of your past now?
I don't own an airplane. I have some friends who do, and we go flying together. They have what they call RV6s, and they're these fully aerobatic airplanes, and they're all military guys. You know, F-15 drivers, a couple F-16 guys, and we go up and fly. And I love flying with them. I mean, we fly just like we did, you know, back in the Air Force. It's a different airplane, obviously. It's not a jet fighter, but these are pretty fun. And I go do it for fun, but you know, that's all. Flying is different. There's nothing that like flying in the military. There's nothing like showing up at the flight line at, you know, at 6:30 in the morning and the crew chief is waiting for you and he salutes you and he says, here's your jet, sir. And you talk about it. And, you know, the whole thing is just, there's nothing in civilian life that can mimic that experience of being, you know, flying jets in the Air Force. But it's still fun, and it's something I'll love to do. Like we said about work, I'll probably fly in one way or another up until the day I die, too.
For those listening that don't know, Chris Stewart owns the world record for the fastest around-the-world nonstop flight. He did that back in 1995, flying a B-1, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and it's been a long time. You said 95, I go, holy cow.
That's, I know.
That's going on like, what, 30 years now?
Yeah.
But it's interesting, Andy, because that record may never be broken. I mean, there's just no other airplane that can fly around the world and fly as fast as we did, as the B-1 did. And people ask me, do you still have the record? I say, yeah. And it's, like I said, we may have that record for a long, long time.
I'm looking at it. Let's see. The team set three world records flying 36,797.65 kilometers in 36 hours and 13 minutes. And that, you know, us Americans, we like to, what does that mean in miles and stuff? But still, that's pretty darn amazing. Do you look back at those times and go, was that really mean? Did that really, I mean, I think back to, first of all, 95 doesn't seem that long ago to me, even though it was. I'm like, yeah, I'm 95. I was, you know, whatever. I was, you know, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and it doesn't seem that long ago.
Yeah, no, it's funny how life does that, right?
Yeah.
It's funny how last week seems a long time ago, but what happened, you know, earlier in our lives doesn't seem that long ago. You know what, too, is I really think this is a personal observation, but you'll forgive me for it, but I really think it's because our spirits, our souls are young. Mm. They don't get older. Our bodies get old, but our spirits don't. And so that we always feel younger. If you ask people, you ask a group of people, how old do you feel? Almost everyone says, I feel like I'm in my 20s, right? You know, people who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, they all feel young. It's because our spirits are young. And
it's
so
true.
Life doesn't, you know, life doesn't seem like a long time ago to us because I think most of us look at it kind of in an eternal perspective.
Now, I got to ask about your side hustles, people like to call them, your other job. As an author, are you still writing books, or have you put the pen away for the figurative pen away for a while?
Yeah, for a while. I mean, I kind of got out of the habit when I was in Congress. I wrote a couple books while I was in Congress. But it you know, it's not something I'm focused on right now, but there are I know, Andy, you and I have talked about it. I wrote a series called The Great and Terrible that had to do, you know, mostly for an LDS audience, although Glenn Beck adapted them and we released them nationally as well. I think that's maybe the only thing I'm going to ever write again, is I want to come back and write a couple more books in that series.
Really?
I don't feel like it ever quite ended. Hmm. And there's a couple more there's a couple more things in that story I want to tell. But other than that, I'm not trying to write right now. Some point I will.
I want a personal endorsement. I haven't read all your books, but one of the books that I read that I just absolutely love is the Seven Miracles That Saved America that you wrote. And if folks are out there looking for a good read, a little faith promoting good read, you know, banner, raise the flag, I love America. That's a great one, Chris, and I appreciate you you writing that. And writing is a discipline. People don't realize, but you can't, I'm going to write a book and then it magically happens. You actually have to sit down and make yourself get the job done. It's not easy, is it?
Hey, so two thoughts on that I think are important. Number one is the title that you said, Seven Miracles That Saved America. But the subtitle, I think, is as important. Why they matter and why we should have hope. Mm. And, you know, Andy, my gosh, people are losing hope in our country right now, understandably, because we see the corruption in high places, and it makes people furious, and it makes them wonder about our country. And there is this reminder that we you know, the country still matters, and we should have hope. You know, if you don't like the things that Joe Biden and other people are doing in our government, and I don't at all, I think it's terribly corrupt and terribly corrosive. But Joe Biden isn't the Constitution. Joe Biden is an America. He's just a temporary president. America, the idea of America still really matters. And then the second note really quickly is, my publishers in New York did not want to publish that book. In fact, they turned me down again and again.
Really?
And I had to go to another publisher, and they said, sure, we'll do it. And it turned out to be a big New York Times bestseller. It was on the list for a long, long time. But it's a good illustration about, you know, the elites, the people in D.C. and New York and L.A. and, you know, Chicago. They don't feel the same way about America. My publisher thought no one cares about America. No one wants to hear stories about America. Well, it turns out they did. But the elites don't feel that way, again, which is why there's so much animosity now between just normal working people and many of our rulers, because they don't feel the same way, many of them, the same way about our country that a lot of us do.
I remember, Chris, a couple of years ago, I went on a cruise out of Galveston, Texas, down to Mexico, and the ship was full of Americans, regular Americans. There were moms and dads, grandpas and grandpas, kids. It was a carnival cruise, so, you know, kids were welcome. And I remember, when we get caught up in this, all this political talk and everything, we hear all these loud minorities, these loud voices, you know, alternate views and lifestyles, and you think, okay, that must be how the world is, or that must be how America is. And then, you know, I went on that cruise, and I saw real America again. I saw all these families and moms and dads that love their kids and grandma and grandpas, and it gave me hope that even though these people, the regular Americans, aren't very loud, they're still there. We still are there and care.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Once in a while, you hear from us.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to hear from us in November. I really do.
Yeah.
I really do.
I certainly hope so. Do you, you know, and we do want to talk a little bit about the race to fill the congressional seat, congressional district too, but I did want to ask you about the presidential race. And, you know, there was a poll out last year, maybe 6 months ago or so, 8 months ago, that said people didn't want Biden and Trump again. They wanted anybody but those two again. And yet those two won their party nominations, or presumptive anyway, and it's going to be Biden versus Trump again. And we've seen what's happened with Joe Biden. You know, it's funny, they look for talking points on how to promote Joe Biden's candidacy, and it's like, well, he doesn't really have anything positive to talk about. But Trump is there as well. There are people that will never vote for Trump, or whatever their reasoning is. There are people that will never vote for Trump. Do you think having those two be our choices? And don't get me wrong, I support former President Trump, and I'm going to vote for him. But do you think having those two again is good or bad for America?
Well, I don't know. I think it depends on who you talk to, and I think it depends on what you mean by good or bad. But people always said, well, you know, Americans want someone else. But the truth is they didn't, because they voted for them.
Yeah.
The Democrats voted for Biden in the primaries. There were challengers, and they didn't. They voted overwhelmingly for Biden. The Republicans voted overwhelmingly for Trump, and there were challengers. There were good challengers. A friend of mine, Ron DeSantis, he and I were elected the same year in Congress. Spent a boatload of time in the green room at Fox, to getting to know each other. I mean, Haley Bailey, Nikki Haley, et cetera. I mean, there's a lot of people, but the bottom line is the Republicans chose Trump. And I got to add one other thing to that, and that is, for those people who are a little reluctant to support the former president, and I get that. I talk to them all the time, and I know. And by the way, at one point I said to President Trump, I said, Mr. Trump, you know, I love you, but man, you make my job so much harder. I get it. I get why some people were, you know, a little hesitant. But here's the bottom line. Americans look at what's happened to him since that absurd raid on Mar-a-Lago, where the FBI runs in there with 32 armed agents.
Yeah.
And a lot of Americans go, that doesn't seem fair to me. That doesn't seem right. They didn't do that to Biden. And then they see these other indictments, and Americans have a basic sense of fairness.
Yeah.
And when we talk about equal application of law, that's deep in our DNA. And most Americans look at this and go, it just seems like BS. It seems to me like they have targeted this guy. And so a lot of people who are a little reluctant to support President Trump are standing by his side now, because they're saying, this is just wrong. And it's clearly partisan, clearly political. And it's interesting to me, this thing that the Democrats thought was going to be his ultimate downfall may be the reason that he's reelected, because people are offended by Democrats going after someone that they hate, have hated for 8 years, and now are using law to try to defeat him. So, you know, you're right, Annie. You go back and some people say, well, you know, these are not the two candidates I would have chose. Well, the bottom line is the majority of the both parties did.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is a lot of Americans are flocking to Trump now because of some of the tactics the Democrats used to try to destroy him, which, by the way, is like scene 47, because they did it with the Russian hoax. They did it with impeachment one. They did it with impeachment two. They've done it now with, you know, four different criminal cases against him. And Americans just see through it. They just know it's just not fair.
You and I are old enough to know and remember that the old Soviet Union and all that stuff sounds very Soviet-like, doesn't it?
Yeah. And one other thing on that that's important to point out, is when the Soviets used the criminal justice against dissidents or against their political opponents, they had reasons. They didn't just go in and say, well, we're going to arrest this guy because he opposes the president. They fabricated reasons, believable reasons. Well, this guy did this. You know, he's an insurrectionist. You know, he's trying to destroy the government. They came up with reasons that sounded reasonable. Like, oh, yeah, maybe he did do that. Well, that's exactly what they've done with Trump. They didn't go in and say, we're going to arrest him because he's President Trump and we don't like him. They fabricated reasons. And the reasons can be kind of confusing to people, and they can be kind of persuasive to some people. But again, it's just not equal application of the law at all.
One of the things, I was at dinner with my brother the other day, and he was talking about how we may be at war with China before too long because of basically we've drawn a line in the sand with China, and of course the Chinese are ambitious and they're talking about Hong Kong and now Taiwan, and I know that's an area that was kind of an area of your expertise. You even told me once that you wouldn't be surprised if China goes after Taiwan soon. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, you know, I spent a lot of time now talking with people, you know, about that issue. I was with, a group of Trump officials a couple weeks ago down in Dallas, you know, including the former National Security Advisor, John Radcliffe, the former Director of National Intelligence, et cetera. Again, they're all people that we work together with. And, you know, that's the question we're asking. And I think we all agree on one thing, and that is China's not going to do anything between now and the election, because if they did, I think they would view that as Trump likely benefiting Trump and Biden taking the blame. And they honestly want Biden to remain the president. I mean, anyone who would argue that the Chinese would rather have Trump over Biden, I'd love to hear that argument because it's so counterintuitive to just logic. So they clearly don't want to influence the election and have, you know, more likely the President Trump be elected. Now, after the election, I don't know. I can tell you that most people are working on a time frame of about 2027. That's when we feel like they're going to be militarily ready. They have to build a number of amphibious assault landing ships and some other things that they still have to, you know, position themselves, including energy independence and economic independence. But if you think they're going to follow a timeline, well, we think they might act by 2027, and that there won't be any surprises. I mean, I think that would be foolish to do. The truth is, we don't know. We don't know what calibrates their decision. We don't know what their priorities are very well. So do I think that it's likely that they try to absorb Taiwan, including military action? I think that's almost inevitable. Do I think it can be deterred? I think it can be deterred, but we've got to do a better job than we're doing now. And do I think it's going to be in the next few years? Probably. It probably will be, but again, there could be surprises. One other thing, Andy, I got to say on that, and this is so important. The war in Afghanistan and Iraq, the war in Ukraine, most Americans didn't pay a real personal price. If you weren't a member of the military, if your family wasn't impacted, most Americans didn't pay a price because of those wars. A war in the South China Sea, every American will pay a price. I mean, the economics of this is devastating. The projections are worse than the Great Depression if there is a conflict that breaks out with China. So, again, this is something that will affect every American and affect them deeply, if for no other reason than the economics.
Wow, that is, the whole thing is kind of depressing and scary, and we need to make sure, first of all, that we have the right president at the helm of this country before any of that stuff
happens. That would be nice.
Yeah.
That would be nice, yeah.
You know, one thing I didn't do, I didn't ask you how long you can stay with me. Are you okay if we take a commercial break and we come back and talk about CD2?
Yeah, let's take a break, and I can stay about 10 minutes after that.
Okay, sounds good. Our representative, former representative, Chris Stewart, is with me today on the Andy Griffin Show. We'll be right back.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back. This is the Andy Griffin Show, 931 on KDXU. Chris Stewart is with me via the telephone. Chris is a renowned author, former congressman, Navy pilot. In fact, see if I can phrase this right. You were the only guy in the world certified to fly bombers and rescue helicopters at the same time. Is that true?
I don't want to argue with my host, but that's actually not true.
That's not true. Okay, no, that's all right.
I didn't fly them at the same time. I flew combat rescue helicopters, and I then went and flew the B-1.
Okay. Well, still, it's a lot better than what I did. I once shot 82% from the free throw line for a whole season. So, that, I mean, there's that, right?
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. See, I'm the exact inverse of you. I would have shot 12% or 18%. No, 12%.
Yeah. Well, Chris, again, thanks for coming on today. One of the reasons that I know that you wanted to come on is to talk about the person that's going to be filling your seat. Now, the primary is coming up. In fact, most people have the ballots already in their hands. And some people have even mailed them in already. But for those that haven't decided yet, it's Celeste Molloy, who was on your staff, against Colby Jenkins in the Republican primary. Tell me your thoughts.
Well, I mean, I just know Celeste. She worked for me for 5 years. There's very few people I have more respect for. In fact, I'd say there's no one that I have more respect for than I do Celeste. And when I realized that I couldn't continue to serve, I went to Celeste and I asked, I think, will you consider running? I think you would be a tremendous congressperson. And I think she has proven that, and I think she will be. She's very well liked. She's well respected back in Washington already. She'll be very effective for Utah, and especially for rural and southern Utah. That's her home. I mean, any person who grew up in a double wide trailer and finds themselves in Congress, that's pretty cool. That's kind of the American dream, right? So, you know, I supported her from the beginning, and I continue to support her. And I just think she's going to do it and continue to do a fabulous job for rural and for Utah.
Tell us about that job. Now, you mentioned Congress has kind of, it's gotten more difficult, and I think the word you used was a mess even. What kind of decisions are going to come her way if she's elected, reelected? She did win this special election, but if she's reelected, that are going to really test her mettle, do you think?
Well, I think the best way to answer what will happen in the future is probably to look what's already happened, what's happened to her in the past. And I mean, there are tough votes, and you have to be willing to say, at the end of the day, you just got to be willing to say, I'm going to do what I think is right. And, you know, there are bullies in Washington, D.C. There are bullies who will come in and try to really pressure you. It's interesting that sometimes they say, well, leadership pressures you or leadership bullies you. That's actually not true. I never felt a lot of pressure from leadership. You know, the speaker and others, the leaders of our party, they almost always said to me, you know, do what you think is right and do what you need to do in order to serve your constituents back home. Some of the bullies come from outside of leadership, and you got to be able to stand up to those people who will take, you know, who will, you know, try to really pressure you or to intimidate you. And I think she's done a good job of doing that. And the second thing is sometimes the things people say about you just aren't true. They're either ill-informed or they're taking something and they're twisting it and trying to create a story about you. And everyone knows that happens in politics. But you got to be willing to stand up to that and say, well, even though I think you're going to do that or you're doing that now, I'm still going to do what I think is right. And I think Celeste has done a great job of doing that.
Celeste has gotten the endorsement from all the House of Representatives, Congress people from the state of Utah. She's gotten the endorsement from Mike Johnson and from Chris Stewart, obviously. And then last night, she got the official endorsement.
Wait. There's one more, too. I'm sorry to interrupt you. One more, too, that I think is interesting. Jim Jordan,
that's right.
Jim Jordan endorsed her, and, you know, he represents a different faction of the party than, say, Mike Johnson. So I think it shows how Celeste kind of, her appeal, you know, is pretty broad. Now, I'm sorry, Andy, you were going to say.
There was one more last night, a big one, as a matter of fact, as Donald Trump officially endorsed Celeste Malloy to represent Utah in Congressional District 2. What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, it's obviously huge. And, you know, and what it says is President Trump has looked at this race. And believe me, I promise you this is true. They don't make endorsements willy-nilly.
Yeah.
To get him to endorse, it takes weeks and it takes a substantial effort. And he doesn't want to endorse someone who's going to lose, for example. So they want to know, is a person I like, can they win? And does the person I'm going to endorse, do they actually support me? Will they work with me? And I think that's what Celeste has proven, is that, you know, it's easy to say to say I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. But can you prove it? And can you prove that you'll do that? You're going to defend the team and try to make things better. And I think Celeste showed that, and that's why the president endorsed her yesterday. You know, we had conversations earlier in the day. And I think there were some things that happened yesterday that led him to that endorsement. I think he kind of took some things personally. And I was really glad to see that. But at the end of the day, he's going to endorse people that he thinks are going to help him with his agenda. He knows that there's going to be a slim majority in the House after the election. The Republicans, I think, are going to keep the House, but they're not going to have a 40-seat majority. They're probably going to have, you know, something much, much smaller than that. So he needs to know that the people he's endorsing are people that will help him. And he knew that Celeste would help him. And at the end of the day, that is the reason that he endorsed her. Some of the personal things, I think, came into play. But more than that, he knew he could count on Celeste.
Well said. He is a former congressman, author extraordinaire, former pilot, and former dairy farmer, Chris Stewart. Chris, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us today.
Hey, I always enjoy it. Like I say, Andy, I miss it. God bless you, man. Thank you.
Anytime you're in southern Utah, you know you got somewhere to hang out if you want, and we'll do lunch. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Chris Stewart on the Andy Griffin Show here on KDXU. We're going to take another commercial break. Be back with more on the show after this.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back, and thanks again to Chris Stewart for being on the program today. Had a lot of good stuff to say. I like that guy. I mean, Stockton, Chris Stewart is a guy who, like, you were like acting plays cool, and I was play sports cool, but neither one of us was Chris Stewart fly B-1s around the world in record time, fly rescue helicopters cool.
I mean, that's like the same kind of stuff you say about Tom Cruise.
Yeah, you know exactly. I mean? Yeah.
Except this one's a former Utah congressman.
And it's real. Yeah, very, very cool. So anyway, thanks again to Chris for being on the program today. I'm not going to say who to vote for. I'm really not. I'm going to leave it up to you folks out there to make that decision yourself. I feel like, honestly, I'm not blowing smoke here. I feel like Celeste Malloy and Colby Jenkins, I think either one of those would do a good job in Congress.
No, I agree. And, I mean, that's the joy of democracy and our country, is that no matter how much hot air is spewed on either side, in the end, it is up to you. So
it is up to you. Absolutely. All right. I'm going to explore a little bit now Stockton's past life as a thespian.
Okay.
Did you ever play the role of a pirate or a outlaw cowboy type character?
I played Captain Hook in high school.
Okay. Captain Hook from Peter Pan, right?
And I played Will in Oklahoma. That's a cowboy, but it's not an outlaw.
Yeah.
But I played the bad guy a couple of times, yes.
So I wrote a story yesterday on 890kdxu.com about an old outlaw by the name of Joe Walker.
Okay.
Joe Walker was in southern Utah in the 1880s and 1890s. and the thing that in doing the research on this, and really something I knew but didn't really think much about, was we make, you know, between video games and movies and everything, we make kind of heroes out of some of these people like pirates and outlaw cowboys who... they were actually not very good people.
No, they weren't. And there is definitely, I mean, you can think, I honestly think you can thank the Wild West genre of movies for that.
Yeah.
And I mean, just look at John Wayne. He played everything from the hero to the killer to, you know, yeah. I mean, one of my favorite characters of all time he played was kind of an unsavory character by the name of Rooster Cogburn.
Rooster Cogburn. I love that movie.
So, yeah. No, I think it is true that we glorify these outlaws and cowboys, outlaws, pirates, cowboys, way too much, that it kind of becomes unrealistic at a point, but that's also the joy of fiction.
So let's talk a little bit. This isn't fiction. This is a fact.
Yes.
Joe Walker. Now, Joe Walker was born in Texas. His family owned a ranch. His dad was a fairly well-to-do rancher, not like a rich guy, but doing all right for himself. But when he was a little kid, Joe's dad died. Hmm. Now, his mom, being a woman on a ranch at that time without sons old enough to help and your husband dies, kind of a bad situation. So she was like, I got to get out. So she moved to the city. She basically gave the ranch to her uncle and said, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to take my baby and we're going to go to the city. And I think they went to Houston or something like that and just raised her son. Meanwhile, the uncle, last name of Whitmore, ran the ranch pretty well, in fact, really well, and to the point where they sold the ranch for a pretty substantial profit, and decided to do the same. They decided to move to Utah and start a big ranch in southern Utah.
Expansion.
Yeah, and try to make it, you know, like the one in Texas. So the Whitmores came to Utah. Now, unfortunately, Uncle died, but his sons were older, and his sons were old enough to run this new ranch in Utah. But at some point, this Joe Walker character grows up, you know, and he says, my dad owned this ranch. We gave it to this uncle. I'm now ready to claim my inheritance. I'm ready to claim my ranch.
Gotcha.
Well, the problem is that the ranch that they had been sold.
Yeah.
And so he decides, okay, I'm going to go up to Utah to the Whitmore Ranch, and I'm going to tell them that I deserve at the very least half of this ranch.
That sounds very much like the plot of a movie.
It does, but only this is real life. So Walker, at this point, he's in his late 20s, comes up to Utah and goes to the Whitmore Ranch and says, okay, I'm ready. Give me what I deserve. That was literally the words he was. I'm here. The words he said were, I'm here to collect what I deserve. Well, the Whitmores were like, no. you haven't done anything to help this ranch succeed, and we're not going to give you a portion or half or any of our ranch. They said, we will hire you. We'll pay you to work here. And he was like, no, I'm not going to work here. I'm tired of being a ranch hand. And so... when he was rejected by the Whitmores, he moved out to the countryside and became basically a thorn in the side of the Whitmores from that point on, to the point where he was stealing horses and cattle. He was burning down outbuildings. He was ambushing and killing ranch hands that got left out. And I mean, this was,
oh my gosh. So he was a straight up murderer.
He was, yeah, vindictive guy. He was a guy that was going to get even for them not giving him his portion of the ranch. At one point, he got drunk and shot up a town in southern Utah. And this was right after he had set a building on fire on the Whitmore Ranch. They formed a posse and chased him down. And in the process, he killed a couple of the members of the posse and got away.
Oh, my gosh.
So... and the reason he got away, he went to Robber's Roost, which is a place that is, You played Red Dead Redemption, right?
Yes.
In Red Dead Redemption 2, there's one point where you go to a very Robert Roos-like place. They don't call it that in a game, but
it's a gathering place for unsavory characters.
And again, it's protected basically by canyon walls and red rocks. And you, so anyway, he ends up joining the gang there, and a little while later joins Butch Cassidy's Wild Bunch gang.
Really?
And they start robbing banks and trains and doing things like that. And but he's still, this whole time, now he's into his late 30s, even 40 years old, and he's still mad at the Whitmores.
Oh, my gosh. What a tool.
Very, very, very vindictive guy. So he goes, at this point, he goes to the Whitmore Ranch and kills a couple of cowhands, farmhands, ranchhands, whatever you call them. And this time the Whitmores have had enough. They form a posse and they chase him, and they chase him for miles and miles and miles. And finally he gets away, but they know kind of generally where he is. And, as he's riding along the trail by himself, he sees this old cowboy there, and he decides to go ahead and, you know, camp with him. You know, you don't want to be alone on the road, I guess, whatever. And he camps with this cowboy. Well, they wake up in the morning, and they're surrounded by this posse, the two of them. Now, historians, as far as they could tell, say the ranch hand or whoever that he camped with that night was completely innocent of anything.
Oh, no. Did he get caught up
in it? But, yes, because he was with Joe Walker, they assumed he was part of the Wild Bunch gang.
And just shot him dead?
And part of the Whitmore vandalism gang and shot them both dead.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So Joe Walker, the cold-blooded killer, the vindictive guy who said he deserved the ranch, well, he maybe got what he deserved. He was killed in the end. So,
where does this all come from? Like, what is this just been a thing that historians have been looking into for a while? Or
yeah, I just, you know, I came across a story online, and by the way, there was another Joe Walker, Joe Rutherford Walker, who was a mountain man in Utah around the same time. He died earlier, but the Joe Rutherford Walker was, by most accounts, a pretty good guy, just a weird mountain man that lived on his own. But this is a different Joe Walker. Anyway, So I came across the story, and I'm like, this is really fascinating.
It is.
And it got me to thinking, what motivates someone to be that angry and that vindictive? I mean,
over something that honestly wouldn't have been all that valuable, honestly.
Yeah, and did he have, I mean, and that's kind of the question I ask in the story. Did he have a claim to part of the Whitmore Ranch? I don't know. His mom, when she gave up the original ranch down in Texas, didn't say, I want it back when my son is of age or anything like that.
Well, and this new ranch, he had no part in it whatsoever.
Yeah.
And the old ranch, he did, right?
Yeah.
So it's like this is a completely new people, new staff, new everything, or at least I assume.
Yeah.
And in a completely new area, and you were that petty.
He was mad.
Yeah, and that's awful.
Vindictive.
Well, it's like, what do you even after all that time, what, they give him his inheritance, and I was like, all right, he's good.
Yeah,
It's like, no.
You can't do that.
You killed tons of people. You can't get away with that.
I conclude the story online, and again, you can read it at a90kdxu.com with this. These stories always end the same. You may get away with being a cold-blooded outlaw for a time, but ultimately you end up in an unmarked grave after being on the wrong end of a gun. And that's what happened to Joe Walker.
That's very poetic and very true.
Sad but true, yeah. Also on our website, 890kdxu.com, hot dog etiquette. It's that time of year we're all cooking, right? Oh, this is serious stuff here.
That was
man.
Quite the jump.
This is serious stuff, right? Okay. People from the National Hot Dog Foundation and the, what is it called? The National
I'm sorry. There's a National Hot Dog Foundation?
Yes, there. Well, it includes sausage in the name, too. I'm trying to get the, here we go. The National Hot Dog and Sausage Council.
Council?
Official council, yes.
What? Are they free?
They have their own website.
Is Anakin Skywalker they're trying to become a part of the council? But it's like, no, you are a hot dog knight, and you are on this council. Nothing more. We do not promote you to the role of hot dog master.
I have some do's and don'ts with hot dogs. Number one, do not put hot dog toppings between the hot dog and the bun.
Yeah.
Always dress the dog, not the bun. I have broken that rule. I will admit, I'll put some ketchup on the bun and then put the hot dog on the ketchup.
Then it's just a sandwich.
Well, I mean, it's less messy. that way. Okay, do not use a cloth napkin to wipe your mouth if you're eating a hot dog. Paper is preferable.
What?
Yeah. Don't take more than 5 bites to finish a hot dog unless it is a foot long, and then 7 bites are acceptable.
Oh, my gosh. There's rules?
So if you have a foot long hot dog, they're literally 12 inches long and you 7 bites. That means you have to bite approximately an inch and a half of hot dog in every bite to get it down.
Pretty reasonable, honestly. I mean, I wasn't surprised when I heard 4 bites for a normal.
Five bites.
Oh, my gosh. I could down that in 2.
Do not use ketchup on your hot dog after you're 18 years or older.
What?
I'm like, what? No, I like ketchup on my dog.
I like ketchup and relish on my hot dog.
Mustard, relish, onions, cheese, and chili are all acceptable. And for heaven's sakes, never, ever, ever put mayonnaise on your hot dog.
I mean, I'm sure it tastes fine, but yeah, that's a little weird. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Probably because I haven't tried it.
Never send a thank you note following a hot dog barbecue. It would be in keeping with the unpretentious nature of hot dogs. It would not be in keeping with the unpretentious nature of hot dogs. And don't bring wine to a hot dog barbecue.
Well, that's just weird if you
do that. Yeah, recommended beverages to accompany a hot dog cookout, beer, soda, yeah, lemonade, and iced tea.
Beer.
Okay, so those are the don'ts. Here are a couple of the do's, and we have about 3 minutes left. So do serve sesame seed, poppy seed, and plain buns with hot dogs. However, do not serve sun-dried tomato buns or basil buns. They are considered gauche when eating hot dogs.
Gauche, yeah, you can't make it too fancy.
Do eat hot dogs on buns with your hands. You should never, ever
eat
your
knife.
Hot dog with a fork.
That's... President Trump and his eating fried chicken with a fork and a knife.
Do use paper plates. Everyday plates are okay. Never, ever use fine china when eating a hot dog.
My mom has broken that rule.
When cleaning your hands after eating a hot dog, you should lick the condiments off your fingers. Never, ever wash them.
Amen, brother. Yeah. I agree, I guess.
And finally, when serving cocktail wieners, you know, the little teeny ones?
Yes.
Serve them with toothpicks, preferably colored toothpicks. Never, ever use a cocktail fork.
Mm.
That's just not right.
Well, again, it makes it too gauche.
By the way, Utahns eat about 180 hot dogs per person every single year.
Okay.
180 hot dogs per person. Now, I can tell you right now, personally, I bet I'll eat 10 a year.
Yeah.
So somebody has got to make up the average, right? If it's 180 per year and I'm eating 10, somebody must have eaten, what is that, a 350 to make up for my inadequacy?
Well, I don't know about you, but like when you're doing a barbecue with your family, I mean, for us, we have one person who smokes some like brisket or something. And then on our side, we just do burgers and then we have hot dogs for the kids. And then if there's hot dogs left over from the kid onslaught, then usually I take one. And so that's like 5 a year at most. The thing is, I love hot dogs. Don't get me wrong. It's just, again, when you're on a diet, hot dogs are one of the most Frankenstein creations that would destroy your body. You love them, though. America.
During peak hot dog season, Memorial Day to Labor Day, Americans typically consume 7 billion hot dogs. That's 818 hot dogs consumed every second. During that several-month period, the hot dog capital of the world is North Carolina. They eat about twice as many hot dogs in North Carolina as Utah.
Is that because there's like a Oscar Mayer factory there or something?
I don't know. I wonder if they put Carolina barbecue sauce on it, if that's acceptable. Ooh. They didn't talk about that.
I put barbecue sauce on a hot dog.
Yeah, that's good. And finally, and I can testify to this because my daughter was there in Chile, the country of Chile. They serve a dish called completos, which is essentially a hot dog, a bun, and it's covered in sauerkraut, smashed avocado, diced tomatoes, hot sauce, and a large drizzle of mayonnaise. They do not, however, in the country of Chile, put chili on their hot dogs.
Well, that's ironic.
There is some irony certainly involved there.
I always thought chili was the home of chili.
Yeah, they don't eat chili. In fact, my daughter told me when she was about to come home from her mission, she said, "Dad, there's one thing I'm looking forward to meeting that I haven't seen for 2 years or almost 2 years when I get home." And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Flavor." Thanks for listening today, Stockton. Thanks for your help. Appreciate it.
Hey.
Also, thanks to Chris Stewart. We'll be back on tomorrow. We'll see you then.